From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a child needed some behavioral health services. Think about how challenging childhood is for all kids. Now add something like trauma. Maybe a family is struggling with poverty or exposure to violence or homelessness. A child might be struggling for a long list of reasons. A child might come from a perfectly contented household and still face all kinds of needs for early intervention. And if they're going to get support, it's fair to ask if the people who offer the support truly understand what they are going through. What about the child's parents? What supports do they need to navigate systems? The Workforce Collaborative Project is aimed at increasing the representation of Black, Indigenous, and people of color family and youth peer advocates in the health and behavioral care workforce in Monroe County. I know that's a mouthful. What it comes down to is peer family advocates, people who have sort of been there, done that, and can help when families, when kids need it the most. And often there's not a lot of representation. Right now, the experts will tell you that the support system is not diverse enough. It's not representative enough, not by a long shot. That's what Tamara Wall found. She was the mother of two young children trying to navigate the early intervention system. And she has learned that getting the support sometimes isn't easy. She's become determined to help change that. It's one of the stories we're going to hear this hour. Our guests are talking about a project to really make change here, to create a truly effective and representative system. And our guests include, I mentioned Tamara Wall, she's with us now, a mother of two and a recent graduate of the Peer Advocate Training Program in the Greater Rochester Parent Leadership Training Institute. We call it PLTI. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Lakia Wilson, who's a pediatrician, medical director of community pediatrics and wellness at Rochester Regional Health. Dr. Wilson, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Sarah Taylor, who is a mother, the founder of the Black Indigenous People of Color PEAK Parent Mental Health Project. Welcome back. Nice to see you as always.
Thank you for having me back.
And John Pavlak is with us, a consultant and trainer for coordinated care services with decades of experience in this field. Welcome. Thank you for being here, John.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Sarah, you reached out to me a few weeks ago. And as I said, I think it could be easy to get lost in a little bit of the jargon and sort of the technical speak here. But it sounds like what it really comes down to is making sure there's truly representation and helping families, caregivers, parents navigate a system sometimes for themselves, sometimes for their kids, when it can feel like, you know, no one knows what you're going through and can relate to it. How would you describe this?
Absolutely. We know that peer advocacy is an evidence-based model. Rather, we're talking adult services, but right now we're talking children and family services. And with peer advocacy as a profession, there is a certain credentialing that is needed to work as a family peer advocate in a community mental health center, in a community-based center. And what we found is that there was a lack of diversity in credentialed family peer advocates. We have amazing family and peer movements, but the credentialing aspect of it, and those that look like me, experience things like me, navigating behavioral health systems, special education systems, and other systems for their children, having another parent, caregiver, peer that can identify, I've been there, done that, also working in a professional position guiding you along the way. And that was the core vision for this project, that we help level the playing field when it came to diverse credentialed peer advocates working across our health and human service system.
I'm sure Tamara and all of our guests will have a lot to say about the moment that you need a peer advocate the most. How do you describe that? How do you know when you need a peer advocate? How do you even know how to find one?
You know, peer advocacy, the title is used pretty broadly.
Yeah.
And when you're in the moment, and I can just share, when you're in that psychiatric emergency room, feeling overwhelmed, feeling helpless, feeling a lot of shame and blame, and you're waiting for professional medical doctors and therapists to help you, having a peer that can hold your hand, that can say, I was up here, I was in that moment. And I think sometimes you don't know what you need until you get it. Many of our parents have said to us, and our peers have said, I wish I had a peer advocate a long time ago. I didn't even know there was such a thing. And one thing we do know, Evan, that when it comes to high poverty census tracts in this community, many of our families that Rochester Regional Health Centers within the school serve don't even know about peer advocacy and the value of peer advocacy, having someone to talk to you about. I can give you another example. I often get a notice for a CSE meeting, a special education committee meeting for my child that says, here's the date, here's the time. And I know to push back on that, to say, did you ask me, was I available? I wouldn't know that unless a special education attorney, an advocate, or a peer said, you don't have to accept that date. You're not available that day. So we have choices, and to have someone that's been there to know that would say to me from a very intimidating email, you need to be here this date and time, to say, ask them for a choice, a time that works for you, or a time when your child may have been in crisis and you were in an emergency room for 12 hours and just feeling overwhelmed and ashamed that you're there, that you can look at a peer, that a peer can come sit with you for a couple hours and say, we don't want you to feel isolated and a lot of guilt and shame.
Well, Dr. Wilson, I'm going to say something pretty naive and idealistic here. I wish the healthcare system, in all of its facets, behavioral health, mental health, early intervention, all kinds, I wish that this was a system that was equipped already to say to families, here's everything that could be an obstacle for you. Here's what you need to know. Here's how we can make you more comfortable. What Sarah is describing, you know, whether you're in that psychiatric crisis moment or just struggling with an early intervention system or wondering how come this is not working for me, how come I'm not able to get the service for my child that I need. I mean, that can be really difficult. And is it naive of me to think, why do we need peer, like, why is the system not working better in the first place?
You are not alone with those thoughts. When I speak to healthcare leaders, we also sit around the table and say, why is healthcare so complex? Mm-hmm. Our families and our patients are really struggling navigating our system. And at Rochester Regional, we really do believe that there should be no wrong door. Whatever point of entry you get into in our health system, we should be able to connect you with what you need. And unfortunately, healthcare is really complex, and we need peer advocates, right? We need family peer advocates. We need patient advocates, right? We need navigators to help us figure out where we're going. And when you think about the times that you come into healthcare and you're experiencing something traumatic, your levels of stress are really high. And even as a provider, if I anticipate all of your needs and share all that information, how much of that information do you actually retain? Even if it's written down and handed to you, you may read those words and be like, I don't even know what this means anymore. I know I had a conversation with my healthcare provider, but having another person sitting right next to you and be able to hear some of the things that are being said to you or help you navigate or say, hey, I have been here before. This is the way that we do this. This is the person you talk to. This is the place that you go to. Someone that you can relate to. And maybe sometimes that healthcare provider, you do not have that relationship to ask those questions, to express your concerns, or it's not there yet. And having a person who has lived experience that you trust, that is from your community, that looks like you, that gets you, that has similar cultures, that makes the whole process a little bit easier.
Doctor, who is the one who is, I'm going to use probably the wrong terminology here, but assigning a peer advocate? I mean, is it... Does someone have to request it? I mean, does someone inside the system say, look, this is a situation where you could really benefit from this? How does that connection happen?
So we're working on that. So right now, Rochester Regional is conducting a pilot where we are hiring two peer family advocates in our school-based health center. So Rochester Regional has five school-based health centers and the Rochester City School District. And each of those individuals will be assigned to two or three schools so that each student that's enrolled in our school-based health center can have access to one of those peer family advocates.
Hmm. And you think about how difficult it is to navigate a system. John Pavlak and I were talking before the program about how difficult it can be to you know, sort of change systems over, and how inertia is probably one factor. You know, I don't want to ascribe malicious motives to a system that doesn't always work very well. Sometimes it is just inertia. But how do you see the system changing, John, and how important do you think this effort is?
So when I came into the system, started working in behavioral health and substance use care, it was still very much entrenched in a medical model about recovery being a reduction of symptoms or elimination of symptoms. And over the last, I hazard to say, 30 years of seeing, I've been really fortunate to be involved in different programs that challenge that idea and start restoring power back to families, start restoring power back to individuals, starting to redefine recovery, right? Recovery is not just elimination of symptoms. It's about having a happy, healthy life. And along the way, I've met, you know, hundreds, probably thousands of people who have been on the same page with that idea. But the system structure, for instance, just the fact that we still are a service-based structure versus a transformational structure, for instance, still occasionally or oftentimes prioritizes the wrong things and creates those situations where it's hard for people to access that. So with this project, for instance, again, family peer advocates, peer support is not a new concept, but there are still vestiges within systems where they are not placed in on equal footing with other professionals, right? There's oftentimes unspoken hierarchies, or there's reasons why those things don't get offered right away. So part of this is to change the culture to think about what every person who's in a position of support and service provides to the individual, and the individual has the choices and how to access those equitably.
Who opposes making these changes?
I don't think anyone opposes making those changes at all. I think it's just a vestige. You know, I worked in, you know, wraparound, motivational interview. I can go. The list goes on of programs and practices that have challenged what wasn't working. Again, I no malicious intent. I think people have good intentions, but the structure of the system, the way that the money flows, the way that people have access to, you know, choices in their own care, that has a lot of catching up to do. There are just, we hear people who, you know, work in this field, they get burned out, they leave because they're trying to help. And there are aspects of the system that don't really accommodate that.
Well, I want to talk about the experience that Tamara had. Tamara's a mother of two. And can you take us through your kind of first experience in this system, and then we'll talk about what you want to do next here.
Yeah. So, as I said, I have two children. One is two and one is seven. But when I was a new mom and I had a two-year-old child, she definitely started to experience some delays. I had no idea of where to go. I have this brand new kid. I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing now. And so I leveraged daycare, but daycare didn't really send me to too many spaces. And then I went to a pediatrician, and the pediatrician tried what she could, and we ended up getting overall getting assessments, and all of these to find out that my child, while she did, yes, absolutely have delays, she was not delayed enough to qualify for services. And that was so frustrating. And so we navigated, right? Again, new mom, we're navigating it. But that didn't sit well with me, and that is now manifested. She's school aged. She's in intervention for different things now, and I always felt bad that I felt like I didn't do enough. There was guilt there of she needed support. I didn't know where to get it from. People weren't really helpful, and we made it, but could there have been more done? And so from there, I decided that no, I don't want any other parents to try to navigate a system that they don't know. She was in school with friends who also had intervention services and who had delays and different experiences. And we were just this circle of parents that didn't know where to go. And so from there, I decided, you know what? I want to be a part of the solution. And I was introduced to the Greater Rochester PLTI, which I was so grateful for because it helped me to find a voice. It helped me to become a better parent advocate. And I learned so many things about how to navigate the system as a parent. But then that also led me to a relationship with another individual who introduced me to the idea of family peer advocacy. And after we talked about it and I started the training for the first time, I know that where there's a lot of focus on helping to empower the people that you work with, but it also empowered me. For the first time, I felt that my experience was valuable, that those experiences of guilt and shame, I could leverage those to help other parents not have to go through that or to feel like it's going to be okay. You will get on the other side of that. So after completing the program, I instantly was like, I have to get involved. There's parents out here that are struggling. And I realized also in my involvement, because I also am involved in my daughter's school district, that it didn't just stop in the city school district. There's kids everywhere across this county that are struggling. And there's so many other parents who have similar experiences, and you might not even know it because it's not highlighted and they're not saying it, and they might be overshadowed by the success of other students, other BIPOC parents that are overshadowed by the success of non-BIPOC kids. And so from there, I'm like, how can I get involved? What else can I do? And it just really reinforced for me that I am passionate about this. My daughter, I'm always going to be her biggest advocate. And from this, me completing this program, it also showed her too that I'm always going to be your biggest advocate, but that we can also help others as well.
You know, I'm not a fan of the, well, this makes a parent a good parent or bad. Like, I don't like to rank things, but I do want to observe that you were very in tune with what was going on with your first child. I mean, here's your first child, and she's very fortunate to have you. I mean, it's very clear here because you're really in tune with the really hard, complicated questions. We talked about how complicated certain health or medical questions can be. I mean, I have one child, he's 12 now, but you know, if you've gone through this, you're looking for, is he talking enough? Should he be reading now? How are the motor skills? Like, is he crawling yet? Should he be crawling? Is he walking? Does it look coordinated? I mean, it's amazing what happens to your brain as a parent when you're trying to observe, is this the right benchmark? Did he meet it? If he's not meeting it, is it a problem or is it quote unquote typical? So for you, you're not only very in tune with that, but you observe that you thought there was a delay. The hard part, well, I mean, the many hard parts, one of the hardest has to be to be told, you're right, there's a delay, but it's not enough to get served. I don't fully understand that situation because your observation was, I think there's a delay, and you're being told, correct, just not enough to get services. Like, what's the line there?
So they have, during the assessment process, they have different scores that they rate different sections. And for her score, she scored higher than what they would have liked for her age, she was slightly below the score that she needed to actually qualify for services through so behavioral services or occupational therapy, things like that. And so that to hear, you know, maybe you needed a 5, for example, and she had a 4, that was so just discouraging. I would have rather you told me nothing.
Like, just, yeah, right. Because you're in like responded. This gray area. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I found out that she didn't qualify, they send you this lovely letter that says, here's all of the ways that your child is delayed. But also here's some recommendations of things that you can do at home or at daycare. And as a single mom who was literally at that time just trying to make it, the last thing on my mind was, okay, now I have to do these additional things as well at home when I'm going to the professionals and I'm talking to the pediatrician and she's upset with me. And that's great that you can empathize, but that doesn't get me the services that I need. And so that's why I think it also is important to have that village around you too, because now I also realize that I could have asked for another assessment. I could have actually, you know, asked and said like, hey, can we maybe reevaluate this? Are there other things that I could consider? I had no idea about any of that. And that's why the family peer advocacy is so important, because you do have people on your side that are like, hold on, no, you can actually ask for another assessment, or you can ask for her to be reevaluated. That was with my first child. My second child is a little bit different because when you notice the delays, you are automatically on it. But then when you have another child who might not have such a significant delay but experiences other things, you might take a little more time to actually recognize that. And so my son, who is exceptionally smart, he is demonstrating other issues, behavioral issues that we need assistance with. My newest struggle is he's not old enough. So I was referred to behavioral therapy only to literally get to the appointment. And they told me that because he was under 5, they couldn't see him. I waited months to get into this appointment.
Why couldn't they have told you months ago?
Literally, right? Right. And so I get down there and we don't get the service. They give me a list with 5 different agencies. I'm almost crying in the waiting room, calling all 5 agencies for them to tell me the same thing, that they do not take anyone under 5. That was, I can't even put into words how I felt that day. I'm crying and my son is like, why are you crying? And I'm like, I'm just so frustrated. I instantly went to my network, my peers, and I need you to help me. And within minutes, they flooded my inbox and my text messages with different resources and things that I could do. That is the power of family peer advocacy. Where I needed to rely on professionals and they weren't helping me in my time of need at that time, I was able to go to my peers and they were able to point me in the direction that I needed to. And I might have to wait a little bit, but at least I have a whole list of actual resources that I can leverage and that I can also share with the clients that I'm going to be working with.
Okay, so a couple questions for you, and then I'm going to broaden these questions really out for the whole group here. But for listeners who are hearing your story, it sounds like at least you were able to make progress with your son by having these resources, knowing where to go. Mm-hmm. For someone listening to this, whether it's themselves or someone they care about, they're going, well, we need that. We need that bad. How do we get that? What would you tell them?
The first thing that I would tell them to do is to open themselves up. So actually, I had the network, but I've also, there's been times when I've reached out just on Facebook, on social media, right? Like social media can be used for other things than highlighting your relationship. But putting it out there, right? And just saying like, hey, I need help. Can someone point me in the right direction? Also, I think a lot of times when I say opening up, people are ashamed to tell their stories, especially when you have more traumatic experiences with your kids. You don't want other people in your business. That's very cultural, or things like that. But put all those barriers down. When it comes to your kids, there should be no walls. Do whatever you need to do. If you need to go on social media, if you need to call different agencies. I sat in a waiting room and called 5 different agencies to try to find something for my son. Do whatever it is that you need to do to get those resources. And then also, you'd be surprised, a conversation from PLTI resulted in me not only finding a new career path, but also realizing that there's other parents who were in need just like me. And so opening yourself up to those relationships that you don't know, ask around. That person that you meet, that friend that you have, you never know how their lived experience can help you. And so just being open to being able to find solutions in any way that you can.
You're hearing Tamara say PLTI again. That's the Parent Leadership Training Institute. They've been around for years now. And I'm sure there's a new cohort sometime soon. They're always. So that's PLTI. What is the future for you now? Tell us about what you want to do next.
So I'm excited to say I literally just left my orientation for a new FPA role. So I am through the training with Ms. Sarah and the rest of her team at BIPOC Peak. I was able to successfully complete the training. And let me say, it is a 6-week training and it's very in-depth. But the support that I received transcended that 6 weeks. I had Angela and Miss Virginia who were working with me well outside of the training to try to get this completed. And so through that training and through the experiences there and the relationships built, I was able to get a job. So now I'm excited to be partnering with a local agency and getting out in the field, helping other parents. I'm also very, very excited to see how we can bring family peer advocacy into my district because we do have children that are struggling there as well. And so just getting involved, getting my hands dirty, and hopefully helping to empower other families to be able to come on the other side of it.
And what do you see as the biggest impact of the lack of diversity in peer advocates?
Well, I think it's very evident, right? So the lack of peer evidence is how you have suspension rates that are abysmally higher for Black and Brown students than they are for their non-white, or for their white peers. The lack of peer advocacy is how mental health challenges can be perceived as behavior issues as opposed to actually diagnosing students and kids and getting them the resources that they need. The lack of peer advocacy is how you have parents that are afraid to go into schools and have meetings about their children, that are afraid to talk to administrators and push back when they're putting labels on their children. That is why we need family peer advocacy.
All right, I want to ask our guests what they hear in your story. And Sarah, I know you know Tamara, but when you hear her describe what she experienced when her first child was 2 and now having 2 children, 7 and 2, and gone through very different but trying experiences with both. I know that's not news to you, unfortunately. You hear those kinds of stories. But it sounds like she's in a bit of a different place now and is on a different path. So what do you hear in this story, Sarah?
The value of peer advocacy and why we need it early on, why we need it in medical settings, why we need it in school settings. So not just the professionals know there's a family peer advocate, that another parent that has a trusting relationship can say, you know what, there's a service you could benefit from. Like Dr. Wilson said earlier, when you are in crisis or you're struggling to get your child services that you know they need, and you get this piece of paper from your pediatrician after sitting in a waiting room for an appointment, you're overwhelmed. But to be able to have another parent call you working and said, listen, I am a peer advocate that also works at this wellness clinic within the school. I am here to support you. I am in here to empower you. John mentioned the inherent power dynamics. When we're talking about systems and levels of care, you have doctors, you have nurses, you have therapists. But often when you put the dynamic of peers in a professional setting, you still have that inherent power dynamic. So, you know, a peer is going to hear another peer's cry like maybe a doctor wouldn't or a clinician wouldn't. And so what I hear through Tamara's story is the value of having that voice that may have walked a similar journey, that can advocate for you at a different way. And, you know, it brings me back to our vision for this model and recognizing that the power of peer advocacy, but the fact that when you have 70-80% Black and brown babies served in our community mental health centers in Monroe County and within our school-based clinics, and the fact that we didn't have credentialed peer advocates. So we knew our hope was through this model, not just putting on another project for a certificate or building skills, which are great, but to design a model with parent input, caregiver input, that would empower and educate someone like Tamara to actually want to get a job to work in this space. So for me, just our first cohort, the fact that we have individuals that said, we just didn't go through this 6 weeks to get a certificate. We want to work. We want to be employed helping other families speaks volume of the power of lived experience.
Let me turn to Dr. Wilson, who's a pediatrician. And, you know, in that story of frustration that Tamara was describing, what did you hear as a doctor? I mean, what stood out to you?
So the audience cannot see me, but I'm smiling as I hear her story because I hear the power in her voice, the advocacy, how she made a difference for her children, and she sought out answers. As a pediatrician, I identify as a Black female. I happen to also be a pediatrician and a mom. And her story, unfortunately, isn't unique. So many of our families are struggling with connecting their children to services, whether it's not identifying what the concern is, that we know there's something going on, but we don't have a diagnosis, or they don't meet the criteria, whether they don't score high enough, and we don't want them to, like, be, you know, we don't want those scores. We want them to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or it's an age cutoff, or resources are not in your community, or it's an access thing, or it's being able to afford their services, or it's being on a waiting list and now your kid's 10, right? So for a pediatrician, it's very disheartening because I have many of these encounters and I'm aware of my narrow scope of how much I know. And to hear her story, that gives me hope of this partnership with the parents, right? It's a privilege to be a part of her village of helping her children grow and meeting all the maximizing all their potential socially, economically, emotionally, physically, mentally, right? And having that partnership. And I'm learning from her as she's learning from me. Because as she'll come into one of my offices, right, and say, hey, I found this for my son and this really helped. I'm going to share that with the next family and mm-hmm. the next family and the next family. So I'm really inspired by this partnership of what I can learn from the peer family advocates and the parents and the things that they found in the community to be helpful and what has not been helpful, and then incorporating that into my treatment plan.
Let me turn to John Pavlak, who is a consultant and trainer for Coordinated Care Services. What do you hear in this story?
A couple of things that really stood out. What an amazing story. And two things that I'm very passionate about in around practice transformation in this work. And the first one was when you said that your experience and your expertise in your own life and your children was valued. That's such an important aspect to this. And oftentimes that gets put aside. A lot of times that's a source of that shame and discomfort, is that, again, people who have expertise not understanding that they're not experts in the lives of the clients and the folks that they work with. So valuing that experience, and then also adopting a, you know, strength-based perspective. Your experience and what you know is so critically valuable. And again, that's something that's still lagging, I think, in this work. And just something as simple as when you're talking to parents, opening the engagement up with just saying, like, what are you most proud of as a parent? But before you get to like, okay, now what are the challenges that you have? I mean, we'll get to all that, right? The other thing is, I'm also a big advocate for just understanding the power of community, that it doesn't get reduced down to just one provider or just, you know, one appointment slot, but that community and to hear the networking that goes on and the you know, the cross-pollination of ideas and understanding is so vitally important. You know, some of the work I'd done in the past, we did some studies on what were some of the most valuable aspects when it came to substance use and mental health recovery. And the answer surprised all of us. It was connection to community. And upon interviewing folks, what we found was that it wasn't just that services and supports were available in the community, it's that they felt connected to other people where they could help to share not only resource, but also some of that burden and also some of that advice and experience. And so to hear that in your story is just so heartening. Like, we know those things are so critically important. And again, not for lack of trying, it's just the systems sometimes are not set up. They, you know, there's only one place where you come in contact with folks. Helping to broaden that and really bring that experience to bear and understand that folks come seeking help ultimately are experts in their own lives first and foremost.
John, are you confident, though, that this can meaningfully change? You've talked about three decades of seeing a lot of sort of stuck systems for different reasons. Do you think they really can change?
They have changed. They have changed. And I've been involved in programs in multiple states around the country where I've seen that change, prioritizing voice, reorganizing towards, strength-based approach, et cetera. I think why this project is so valuable is because the one part that we haven't really accounted for is that when the intersectionality starts to stack up, there are still parts, like, that's why it's so important to have diversity in the workforce. That part is still definitely lagging because those experiences go deep. There's a broad range. And for as much as there has been solid progress and change in culture around this kind of work, we still need to get voices that build a complete narrative, not just the one that, has been built to this point.
We have to take our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to some feedback from listeners. We got a phone call I want to take. Listeners asking, how many people are you looking to bring into this kind of work? Well, I don't know if Sarah's got the exact answer on that. We're going to talk about how this might be funded and supported in the future. And we'll come back and get that listener feedback after this only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, we welcome the Reverend Dr. Michelle Bogue-Trost, who is the new leader at Asbury First United Methodist Church. When Dr. Stephen Cady and his family moved to Texas this summer, there was an opening at one of Rochester's most progressive churches. And Michelle Bogue-Trost joins us to talk about her career so far, why she took the job in Rochester, and how she sees the work. That is next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. David, I'll take your call in just a second. Had an email from a listener who wanted to know how many people are doing this work right now and how many are you looking to add, Sarah Taylor?
Well, we are fortunate through the Mother Cabrini Foundation that we hope we have a couple different outcomes we want to accomplish. The awareness about the project, we're hoping to, about the peer profession, we are hoping to educate over 200, many, particularly those in high poverty census tracts in urban areas and suburban areas, don't even know about the family peer advocacy profession. So we're hoping to reach at least 200 to share about it. How can I ask my doctor for a family paravic? Can I find a family paravic at where at? So we're hoping to educate 200. But to actually train and to help credentialing, we are expecting that 70 individuals will go through our cohort each year, and that at least 40 will become credentialed. And where you ask me, where are the jobs? Well, the first stop for the jobs is at Rochester Regional Wellness Clinics. There's five within the city school district. Rochester Regional also has wellness clinics in the suburban schools. So Rochester Regional has been the healthcare partner that has said, we believe in family voice and we want to hire. So Rochester Regional is right now and will be hiring family peer advocates. We also know that there's plenty of organizations in our community, Hillside Family Agency, St. Joseph Villa, Mental Health Association, and many others that have jobs, CompEAR, for family peer advocates. So not only in Rochester Regional, we want our cohort graduates that we are targeting 40 a year to put through credentialing, because you cannot work in this profession without the credentialing. And one of the goals in the challenges that we've seen when it came to completing the credentialing, it wasn't easy as just going online. And as Tamara mentioned, we had to coach throughout that 6 weeks. How do you go through this module? How do I upload, write a statement of lived experience? So this is a professional experience. And through this collaborative with CCSI Rochester Regional, we are hopeful that our coaching, our mentorship, our classes will, we have just in June, six that got their credentialing. And so we are excited that our goal is 40 a year, because the jobs are out there.
How are people going to find you if they want to do this?
Well, they can find us by emailing us or going to our website, bipopparentvoice.org. They can sign up for an informational session that we have every Wednesday. We have informational sessions that they can sign out about the class or the cohort, or if they are credentialed or interested and may not fall within our project scope or criteria, we still will direct them to resource for credentialing or jobs.
And David, just hang there for one more second. I just want to ask Dr. Wilson. Dr. Lakia Wilson is with us from Rochester Regional Health. And I want to ask you how many parents and caregivers you interact with who would know on their own coming into your office that peer advocates are a thing.
I would say very few.
Right, yeah.
Very few.
That's what I would say. So isn't, again, if we're going to be on the idealistic train, isn't the idealistic situation where the system will say to those parents and caregivers, hey, you may not have known that this is out there, but we want to help provide this for you, as opposed to, hey, they asked for it, they knew to ask for it, here, what can we do for them?
Absolutely. Like, Rochester Regional is known as your community provider from the day that you conceive all the way to geriatrics and everything in between. And we truly believe we're rooted in community. We're partnering with the community. And it's important for us to promote the services for whole health well-being. And so I think as a job as my pediatrician, is not only to say, oh, is your child doing this? And, oh, you're due for vaccines, but also to really highlight, promote, educate about programs in this area that our families have access to.
All right, let me get David, who's been waiting on the phone. Hello, David. Go ahead. David, are you there?
Hello, thank you.
Yep, go ahead.
Yes, I am. First, I want to thank Dr. Wilson for the hiring peer support advocates, family peer advocates. I myself am a certified family peer advocate. And when I looked back in January, I was stunned that there were absolutely no positions available at either Unity, Strong, or Rochester Regional. So I'm very glad that this is happening. Second off, I was on the program about 3 weeks ago when you had Samara Brook.
Oh, here. You called her. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I can finally announce that three support groups are going to start September 3rd, 5th, and 7th in connection with the Mental Health Association of Rochester. And I can give details for that to anyone who's interested. They do need to register because spaces are limited because these are in-person support groups. They're not online. And we limit it to 16 people just so everyone has the ability to speak.
If you can here, I'll put you back on hold and give us the information, David, and we can post it with our show notes.
Sure.
Yeah, we appreciate the phone call. That's coming up in just about a month now. Boy, oh boy, that's less than a month away. Summer is flying along here. But I appreciate the call. Do we know how many Davids are? How many actual peer advocates are working right now? Do we know, Sarah?
Well, there's multiple peer advocates. You have the recovery peer mm-hmm. advocates, and our model right now focuses on youth. Family. We will focus on youth in the fall. So I would say I could just speak for Monroe County throughout our organizations. And again, credentialed family peer advocates mm-hmm. working as a profession. We may have maybe 50 to 60 working across our health and human service organizations. And that number may be pretty high when it comes to family peer advocacy. Family peer advocacy under the Office of Mental Health is a Medicaid billable services that is offered not just in licensed mental health organizations, but other community-based organizations. And as Dr. Wilson said, I believe it's the biggest hidden secret in family services.
Medicaid billable, you said?
Medicaid billable services under treatment family support services. And it is, and I can particularly speak, not for all, but for the Black and Brown community, in high poverty census tracts that may have Medicaid, it is a big hidden secret. That also may have a child with a behavioral health diagnosis that could qualify for this. It's the biggest hidden secret in this region.
Well, I think of it in a way that my dad told me years ago. He said, you know, as you get older, he said, in just about everything you do, it's going to be valuable if you have a mentor for your work, for different hobbies you want to get better at. It's also a good idea if you learn how to mentor other people, because that'll sharpen what you can add and how good you are at doing anything. He said, look for mentors all throughout your life. Well, I think about, you know, producer Megan Mack has talked in this program about 3 years ago when she was diagnosed with breast cancer and the importance of having people who have gone through breast cancer to talk to you about what may be coming. What is chemo like? What is recovery like? You know, they tell you X, is it really Y? And that was tremendously valuable for her. She shared that on this program. And we've talked to people with different support organizations, and that's just one example. Some of what I'm hearing, you know, Tamara talk about, it's almost in that vein of having someone who's been there, done that, who can hit you with any surprises that may be coming. So when you think about the work that you want to do to help others, what are the common, either mistake is the wrong word. I don't think you made a mistake as a parent if you're not aware of different options. You talk about, hey, we can get reassessed here. I didn't know we could get reassessed. You know, Sarah talked about, I didn't have to take this appointment. I can say, I'm going to push back and reschedule here, and I don't have to just take the first thing they offer. What are maybe the common missteps or pitfalls out there that you think families and caregivers are facing?
I think one of the biggest pitfalls is that you, especially when you're in a traumatic situation involving mental health, you might get a diagnosis or you might get a determination and you think that's it. But maybe changing the perspective and changing the question and not, you know, is that it or okay, but what else? And so switching to that perspective allows not only you to kind of get your power, restore your own power and say, nope, I don't accept that now. Is there something else that we can look at? Is there something else that we consider? But it also causes that provider to actually have to take a step back and say, okay, this parent is non-relenting. Let's go ahead and see what else we can do or what else we can find out. And sometimes also being open that, you know, if they tell you that it's why, sometimes it is why. But at least you can feel okay with knowing, like, I've exhausted everything that I could. And also not being afraid of that partnership. Essentially, when it comes to caring for your family, especially with a professional, that is a partnership. They are not to, they're not there to tell you what the, what you need to do. They are not there to diminish any part of your experience. They are your partner. So going into the relationship with that, how I'm concerned about the delays that my child is experiencing, how can we work together to make sure that they're covered? That is that is critical in navigating these spaces. And I think one of the other things that we can do is, as both Dr. Lakia and Ms. Sarah called out, is that high stress. You get these things, and all of a sudden you start thinking, I saw delays in my child, and instantly I started thinking that she wasn't going to do all of the things that I dreamed about her doing. Mm-hmm. Taking a step back and realizing that, yes, this is the scenario right now. It does not have to be the scenario going forward. This is the scenario right now. It doesn't change who she is. She's still your loving, bubbly baby that you love. What are you going to do to support her where she's at right now? And that's not anything that a professional can do for you. That's what you have to do as a parent. Just take a step back once you're out of those feelings and just assess the situation. Your child is still your child. Your child still needs you, and they still need that example of, I need your support. What does that look like? And so when you switch your perspective to that, then that allows you to kind of think, okay, I'm in a critical mode right now. I'm not feeling everything that I just heard, but that's okay. Where can I go? Who can I reach out to? And then again, going back to that opening yourself up of, who's my network? Who knows people? Where can I go? Where can I reach out to get the resources that you need?
Well, how are you doing? Are you gentle on yourself?
Am I gentle on myself? You know, I am in a season where I am reclaiming my voice. I've been a mom for almost 8 years. I am a single mother. So I've had to overcome a lot in that journey. And a lot of it was survival based. I was just trying to make it, or I was just trying to get the resources for my daughter and navigating all of these things, or even for my son. Now I understand again that my experience has value, that I have value as a parent, that regardless of what delays or intervention needs my children may have, that I'm an excellent mother. I'm not a good mom. I'm an excellent mom because I advocate for them and I speak for them in those spaces where they can't speak for themselves. And I try to make sure that we've exhausted all options before I accept any label on my kids. So today, I'm good. If you'd asked me even a few months ago, it might have been different. But thank you to programs like the FPA training and people on, you know, Miss Sarah and Miss Virginia and Angela and everyone on her team, and also PLTI as well. In this season of my life, I've been able to reclaim my voice. My kids see power, and so I'm good. I'm good.
And your oldest is only 7, but they know, like they see, right? They see you advocating. They see you working.
She does. She's my biggest hype man. I love it. And she knows also that I'm hers. And so my kids, you know, we have a huge community in a village and I love my family, but it's me and my kids and we are doing well. We're doing good.
Dr. Wilson, before we lose the hour, I think it's always valuable to kind of get the perspective of doctors, pediatricians like yourself on, you know, we've heard for a long time in the American healthcare system that everybody, especially patients, but doctors too, want more time face-to-face. How are you doing with that, and how is that challenge?
Oh, my goodness. It is a challenge. I love my families. We can chat for hours if I was given that time. It is it's a challenge when I may have only 15, 20 minutes with the family. And there's so many things that we have to discuss. And it's really what they want to discuss and things that we could do. But I love hearing about the good things. I love hearing about the bad things and how together can we come up with solutions. I love watching the children grow. I love watching the families get stronger in the communication, and I just wish I had more time with them. And that's part of the reason why I do a lot of advocacy stuff in the community as well, that is outside the doctor's office. So it's not so medicalized, that it's really about watching families grow, strive, and meeting their fullest potential.
Well, before we lose this hour, Sarah Taylor, what do you want listeners to know? What do you want them to take from this hour?
The value of family peer advocacy is important, and spreading the word and awareness about peer advocacy services, and that we amplifying, as I always say, amplifying lived experience is powerful. I sat with you a couple years ago, and it wasn't good enough just for me to sit here. But to take what I know and empower parents like Tamara and the thousands and hundreds that we hope will be aware about family advocacy, peer advocacy credentialing in that profession does me well. So that's my hope, not just to sit here, but next time have five other parents that are here to share their experience.
Keep coming back. You'll be welcome to do that. John, what do you want to leave with listeners?
I just want to say, I'm in my third year living in Rochester, I just want to say, and getting to know the community and the folks here that do the work, getting to know Sarah and you, all the folks around you, your tenacity and just absolute do not quit is really inspiring. And what I've seen happen here in Rochester, Monroe County, and I know this is going to go way beyond that, is I think it's truly exceptional, like a lot of things in this community. And so really just honored to be part of, small part of that project, be in support of what you do. And so I think we're going to continue to see that transformation that you asked about. It's happening right now.
We're going to make sure that we've got links in our show notes page if you want to learn more about what you have heard about this hour with this project and with BIPOC Peak and everything else that we have talked about this hour. I want to thank Sarah Taylor, who is the founder of the Black Indigenous People of Color, the BIPOC Peak Parent Mental Health Project. Thank you for being back here.
Thank you.
Yeah, like I said, keep us updated. Come back anytime, Sarah Taylor. Dr. Lakia Wilson, a pediatrician and medical director of Community Pediatrics and Wellness at Rochester Regional Health, thank you for sharing your expertise today.
Thank you.
I want to thank John Pavlak, who is a consultant and trainer with Coordinated Care Services. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for amplifying this work, Evan.
And Tamara Wall, who is mother of two and a recent graduate of the program we've been talking about, doing great work in this community. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
More connections coming up in just a moment.